Anthony Blinken's visit and the outcome of this visit, and how, what is he trying to do in your opinion?
I think we're involved in a very delicate balancing act taking place that's designed to do a couple of things. Preserve Benjamin Netanyahu's political viability as the Israeli prime minister and prevent a broader regional conflict. What makes this difficult is that in order for Benjamin Netanyahu to retain viability, he has to be seen as A, being a wartime leader, and B, pursuing policies designed to win wars, not acknowledge defeat. The Americans who are pushing for a ceasefire are pushing for an outcome, a ceasefire, that would be the political ruin of Benjamin Netanyahu. So to offset the political consequences of accepting a ceasefire, which I believe eventually Israel will have to do, Netanyahu is engaged in very dangerous provocations regionally that promote him as an aggressive defender of Israeli security. This is why he carried out the assassinations in Beirut and in Tehran. And this is why Israel continues to carry out aggressive bombing attacks in Lebanon, Syria, and elsewhere. This allows Netanyahu to say that I have not surrendered. I am defending Israel's national security, but doing it in a way that doesn't automatically provoke a Hezbollah or Iranian response. I mean, I think most people believe that there will be a Hezbollah or Iranian response. But the fact that it's taken this long implies that both Hezbollah and Iran are weighing the risks associated with such a response and maybe seeking to mitigate the scope and scale of this response in a way that enables them to resolve domestic political criticism that they've allowed Israel to get away with literal murder without provoking Israel to carry out an even larger counterstrike. So it's a very, very delicate game being played that involves domestic Israeli politics, domestic American politics, domestic Iranian politics, domestic Lebanese politics, and good old-fashioned geopolitical posturing.
Yeah. Here is what Anthony Blinken said during this visit.
The first is to reaffirm the commitment of the United States to Israel's security. That's a commitment that we put into practice virtually every day since October 7th, including when Israel was attacked directly by Iran back in April. In recent weeks, given the heightened tensions, we have deployed additional assets to the region. The purpose of the deployment of these assets is not to provoke aggression, but rather to deter it, to make sure that it doesn't happen. But also to make clear that if it does, we are fully prepared to defend Israel. We've coupled this effort with an intense diplomatic campaign, virtually a global diplomatic campaign, working with countries around the world to send the message strongly to every concerned party not to take any steps that would escalate tensions, that would risk provoking a wider conflict. And this, too, has been something we've been working on from day one, since October 7th. It's been one of our primary objectives, to prevent the conflict from escalating, from spreading to other places. And so this coupling of our military commitments, our security commitments, with an intense diplomatic campaign is something that I'm pursuing on this trip, again, with the intent of making sure that we deter further conflict, but that we're also clearly prepared to defend against it if it comes. But what's most crucial now is that everyone refrain from taking any actions that could fuel further conflict, escalate tensions, and result in the spreading of violence and conflict.
Yeah. The question is, Scott, when he says that we are ready to defend Israel, but at the end of the day, what's mattered the most is how they are trying to convince Netanyahu to go after some sort of ceasefire, because that would be the main that would be the most important solution for this conflict in Gaza, not Iran and Israel, because it's a production of this conflict.
First of all, we have to understand that when the United States says that, or when the Biden administration says that America will defend Israel, they mean just that, defend Israel. That does not mean that America will participate in Israeli offensive actions against either Hezbollah or Iran. And I think that's one of the unspoken realities of the situation that the United States is communicating directly to Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel, that the U.S. will be there if Iran chooses to attack Israel, to retaliate for the Israeli assassination that took place in Tehran. But that if Israel chooses to extend its operations into Iran to launch a major counterstrike, that the United States will not participate, that Israel will be very much on its own, that Israel has put itself in this situation and the United States isn't going to get it out of it, that we will defend Israel, but we won't participate in any offensive action. And I think this is a big card that's being played because, throw out an example here. Right after the assassination, Russia flew in many flights of advanced surface-to-air missiles, S-400s, electronic warfare equipment, radars, etc., that have significantly upgraded Iran's defensive capabilities. This changes everything about the Israeli attack profile. Whatever attack plan that Israel had to strike Iran now has to be significantly modified to take into account these new weapon systems. And Israel may, in fact, not have the capacity to launch meaningful attacks that can defeat this new enhanced defensive posture of Iran. And so the combination of the United States saying, we're not going to help you out to attack Iran, and Iran upgrading its defense has hampered Israel's response potential, limited their options. And so, this is something that all parties are taking into account, to include, I believe, Iran, which will seek to strike Israel. Iran must, but will do so in a way that, doesn't create an imperative that Israel must respond meaningfully, that hopefully that this thing can, go away, just like what happened in April when, Israel attacked the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Iran responded, and then Israel did a token retaliation, and that was the end of it. I think all parties are hopeful that that can be the outcome of this current crisis.
And how do you see the mind of Netanyahu and his administration right now? But it seems you say that the United States is saying that we are not going to be part of any sort of attack on Iran. But in the mind of Netanyahu and his administration, it doesn't seem to be like that. They're thinking that if something big happens, the United States will be part of that operation. That's why they're not trying to negotiate, despite everything coming from the, I don't know if you accept that Antony Blinken is doing his best to convince Netanyahu or not, but at the end of the day, one of the main reasons that they're not considering any sort of ceasefire because they're thinking that if something happens between Iran and Israel, the United States would be part of this.
I don't know how Israel can believe that. I believe that Israel was set straight when Netanyahu visited the United States. He got his massive, rounds of standing ovations, 54 or something of that nature, in Congress. But then he had to go and be briefed on reality by the Pentagon and by the White House, where I believe both the Pentagon and the White House put him on notice that America will defend but will not participate in offensive actions. And I think this is what prompted Netanyahu to authorize the assassinations, because he had to do something. He stood before Congress and promised massive strikes against Hezbollah, massive strikes against Iran. But when he was told that this was impossible because the United States wouldn't respond, he didn't back away. He simply refocused his efforts, carried out these assassinations, which were terribly provocative, terribly provocative. The United States could not have been happy with this, but It allowed Netanyahu to posture and say, I am the national security prime minister. I am the leader of Israel that's capable of carrying out these decisive strikes. I have sent a signal to Hezbollah, Hamas, and Iran that Israel will not be trifled with. So he gained some political ammunition domestically by doing that. And that, when combined with the fact that the United States Congress anointed him as the ultimate Israeli leader that America relies upon, I think positions him to be able to consider to enter into negotiations about a ceasefire. But Netanyahu is not just going to roll over. He is looking to maximize his political viability. He has to be careful, because if he accepts a ceasefire that is seen as surrender by his coalition, then his coalition collapses and he may not stay on as prime minister, even though he has the American flag wrapped around his shoulder. So he is going to continue to play this very dangerous game of escalation management, up until which time either he gets a deal that's acceptable or he reaches the end. And the danger here is that if he pushes it too far, then you get an Iranian retaliation, then you get a Hezbollah retaliation, then you get a regional war, and that's an option that nobody wants.
And as you mentioned, do you think that part of this is a strategy on Iranian strategy toward the considering the response that they're going to have? Do you think that because of the way that they're thinking, that this negotiations that are going on between the United States and Israelis in order to have a political settlement, do you think Iran is still hoping that it's going to have something coming out of these negotiations, or that's why they're just not attacking Israel right now? They didn't respond so far. And because everybody's asking why Iran is taking too much time to respond.
Well, what are Iran's strategic objectives here? To be seen as a nation capable of responding to Israel militarily? They've already proven that. Iran is a nation that has a strategic objective not of defining its role in the Middle East through military supremacy. Iran's military power is meant to be a deterrence against outside aggression against Iran. Iran wants to be a geopolitical player that focuses more on its economic potential and its ability to leverage this economic potential into, regional, not dominance, but to be a player regionally. And the region we're talking about is not just the Middle East, but Eurasia. Iran is focused on BRICS, joining BRICS, preparing for BRICS. Iran is focused on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran is focused on a European Economic Union. Iran is focused on everything but war. It doesn't want a war. It's not seeking a war. You remember, Iran didn't ask for this crisis. This crisis was brought on Iran by Israel, that opted to carry out an assassination in Tehran. And so now the question for Iran is, do we, go with our emotions and bomb and throw away all this potential we have of economic revitalization, geopolitical relevance, or are we patient? And do we play this thing out, managing escalation so as not to create a regional conflict that undoes decades of work that Iran has been involved in trying to position itself to be right where it is, a nation on the cusp of geopolitical relevance, reemerging into the family of nations as a major player. This is a role that Iran believes it deserves, it warrants, but it hasn't been able to achieve because of, decades of sanctions and isolation. They now have the potential to break out of this. Do they really want to be dragged back down into the morass simply because people say, we have to bomb Israel? I think Iran's playing this very smart. And I say the same thing for Hezbollah. Hezbollah is no longer just a resistance movement. It is a political party that plays a very important role in Lebanon. And Hezbollah is, invested a lot of political capital into getting to this position where the Lebanese people trust Hezbollah to do that which is right, not just for the Shia, not just for Hezbollah, but for Lebanon as a whole. So it's not in Hezbollah's interest to engage in a major confrontation with Israel that would drag Lebanon into this conflict and do tremendous harm on Lebanon at a time when Lebanon simply can't afford to have harm done to it. So again, Hassan Nasrallah is showing his maturity as a leader, a Lebanese leader who has, you know, regional geopolitics on the mind by not drastically escalating in response to Israel's provocation of the assassination in Beirut.
Can we say that this attack, this problem that you're witnessing between Gazans and Israel is unifying all of the parties? Because the news shows that it seems that in Lebanon, the situation, the position of Hezbollah is getting better and better. They were not in the same position before this conflict started between Israel and Gazans.
Hezbollah has emerged as a political power in Lebanon, not just the representative of Hezbollah interests, but somebody represents the interests of all of Lebanon. And I think the maturity of Hassan Nasrallah in approaching this issue, focusing on what is best for promoting Palestinian interests, which ultimately mean promoting the creation of a Palestinian state without destroying Lebanon in the process. I think the Lebanese people recognize that, the role he has played, the role that Hezbollah has played, has been a very positive one for Lebanon and the region. And this is why you see Christians, Sunni, even Shia factions, Druze, rallying around Hezbollah, saying, we support you in this endeavor.
And the other country that is important is Egypt right now. It seems that they're having some difficulties with the United States and Israel, considering the Philadelphia corridor. And how do you see the situation of this? And why Israelis are doing this? Does it make sense in your opinion?
Well, the Israelis are doing this from a security perspective. They believe that Egypt has failed in its responsibility of policing the border between Egypt and Gaza. There's every reason to believe that Hamas has a lot of connectivity, underground connectivity between Gaza and Egypt that has been used to funnel in weapons and supplies. One of the reasons why Hamas has been able to sustain this 10-month-long conflict. And Israel believes that Egypt has done a very poor job. And so Israel's position is if there's going to be a ceasefire, we have to ensure that Hamas does have the ability to reconstitute its forces, because that would just bring us back to square one. And so Israel's demanding that, insisting that it retain control of the Philadelphia corridor, which is a direct violation of the Camp David peace accords. And Egypt is from a legal standpoint saying Israel has no right to do this. But the fact is Egypt's in a difficult position because it hasn't done a good job of policing that corridor. And the question is, was this incompetence? Was this a deliberate oversight on their part? We don't know. Only the Egyptian government knows. But this puts the Egyptian government in a very, very difficult position.
Is the situation in Israel helping the Biden administration in 2024, considering the Democratic Party? If not, why they're not trying to do the maximum thing that they can do in order to convince Netanyahu?
I mean, that's a political question that the Biden administration is weighing right now. On the one hand, in the America of today, it's impossible for a major political player to seek national office, especially the presidency, without bowing before the shrine of Israel. And you see the Biden administration doing that. You see Kamala Harris saying the same thing. She would do that. Trump is doing that. RFK Jr. Was doing that. The only one who's not doing that is Jill Stein and Cornel West, I guess. To be honest, while I respect their respective positions, they aren't going to win the election. But on the other hand, especially in the Democratic Party, there are important demographics in critical, states, battleground states, especially Michigan, Wisconsin, that have taken such offense at the Biden administration's support of Israel's genocide, the facilitation of the continued murder of Palestinian children and civilians by Israel using American bombs, that, the posture of the Biden administration vis-a-vis Israel could cost them these states. So it's a very difficult position for Biden. And what makes it even more difficult is that if Biden softens, or if Kamala Harris softens her position on Gaza, takes a more conciliatory posture towards the Palestinian cause, she's going to lose, pro-Israeli voters who will just jump over to Trump, because for pro-Israeli voters, it doesn't matter so much the D or the R. What matters is Israel and which side is going to, best support Israel. So it's a very difficult position for the Biden administration to be in right now. And this is one of the reasons why I think you see Anthony Blinken, in the Middle East, in Israel, working hard to try and get some sort of ceasefire, because the sooner they can get a ceasefire, the sooner they can say, look, we did everything we could to bring an end to this war, but we did it in a way that Israel, the state of Israel, agrees with. And so it'll be the best of both worlds for the Biden administration.
Is Netanyahu thinking that he's winning the conflict? That's why he's not willing to negotiate. He's not willing to have any sort of political settlement. Or is it something else in his mind that he's seeking for?
I don't think Netanyahu thinks he's winning militarily. I think he knows the opposite. I think he is seeking to survive politically. I think this entire posturing by Israel is about Netanyahu's continued political survival. And the shame is that he's putting, not just the existential survival of Israel on the table, but he's putting, thousands, tens of thousands of Palestinian lives on the table, just because he wants his political legacy to be that of a leader that isn't tainted by corruption charges, isn't tainted by military defeat. He wants to emerge from this crisis as the savior of Israel. And I think that's what's driving him, not some artificial belief that Israel's winning, but the necessity to sell an Israeli victory to an Israeli public, even if it isn't necessarily the victory that Netanyahu originally promised.
If we compare Russia and Israel during these two conflicts, we can say definitely that Russian army is getting stronger, stronger, and more strategically thinking than. But how about the Israeli army? Are they getting stronger, in your opinion?
I don't believe so. I think the Israeli army is getting weaker. Materially, they're exhausted. They've run out of spare parts for their tanks and armored vehicles. So they can't repair damaged vehicles, which means that they are depleting their frontline stocks and having to replace them with, older mothballed equipment, which is a reduction in capability. Their military, isn't designed to fight a 10-month-long war. They're designed to fight shorter conflicts, conflicts that have less emphasis on infantry on infantry engagements and more emphasis on exploiting technological supremacy on the part of Israel in terms of the tech, the equipment they bring to bear, most of it provided by the United States. Israel is morally exhausted. The most moral army in the world has turned out not to be, turned out to be actually an army of genocidal murderist rapists. Not all Israeli soldiers behave in this way, but a significant number do. And now what we're finding out is that there's a significant element in Israeli society that supports this kind of behavior, which creates a moral dilemma for Israel itself as it looks to the world to say, we need the world's support to continue to survive. And the world is looking at Israel saying, we can't support you and we probably never will as you're currently configured. So the idea that Israel today is stronger than it was on October 6th, I think, is ludicrous. Israel is far weaker.
The other thing that Iranians are talking about, fighter jets, buying fighter jets from Russia. Do you think that if that happens, what would happen to the situation between Iran and Israel? We're going to have the tension's going to go going to increase or decrease in your opinion?
I mean, Israel has long said that it doesn't support Russia providing, equipment that is the equivalent of that which is provided by the United States to Israel or close to it. But, you know, Israel has created a situation where Russia almost has no other option because Israel's behavior is so egregious. The assassination of, a senior Hamas official in Tehran. A Hamas official, by the way, who was leading the negotiations to bring about a ceasefire. And then, Israel, this kind of brazen behavior demands a response. And as Russia, as Lavrov warned Israel, Russia will not sit on the sidelines forever. And so Russia now has gotten off the sidelines is in the process of upgrading Iran's military capability, which will complicate any potential future conflict between Israel and Iran to the detriment of Israel.
They were telling Iran that don't attack Israel because we are negotiating right now. Just be prepared. We're going to have an agreement. And Qataris were talking about this. Washington was talking about this. But at the end of the day, do you think that we are all prisoners of Netanyahu's position? That's why they cannot convince him, because if he loses his position, that would be dangerous for him. That's why he has to continue this war, and nobody's able, even these Arab states, together with the United States, together with the tensions, growing tensions between Iran and Israel, all of them together are not capable of convincing Netanyahu.
Again, Netanyahu, what are you trying to convince him of? Political defeat? Because this is what, if Netanyahu concedes and accepts a peace plan, that can be spun as an Israeli defeat, and it would be spun as an Israeli defeat by Netanyahu's political opponents and even Netanyahu's political allies who are looking for a military victory promised by Netanyahu. That's the end of Netanyahu politically. And given the fact that he has a number of corruption charges hanging over his head, it's the end of Netanyahu. It's the end of his life. So this is all about Netanyahu. And I think the United States and others recognize this, and this is why everybody's working so hard to come up with some sort of solution that gets what the Palestinians insist on, which is a pathway towards a Palestinian state, while allowing Netanyahu with a graceful exit to say, I stood up for the defense of Israel, and now I can bow out gracefully, not leave with the tail between the legs. It's a very, almost an impossible juggling game. But it's the one that they're being played because Netanyahu has put his own personal ambition above that of what's best for the state of Israel.
If you were to assess what Saudi Arabia and UAE are doing to help Gazans, what would you point out in terms of this assessment?
I don't think the Arab world is helping Gaza at all. I think they're betraying Gaza. Right now you have the Saudis talking about that from their position, maybe the most beneficial path for regional stability is normalization with Israel. That would be the legitimization of genocide, of murder of the Palestinians. You have important Saudi influencers, talking about the Palestinians as, a non-existent state, a non-existent people. The same thing with many of the Gulf Arab states. So I think this is the unfortunate reality of the Palestinians, that they have been betrayed consistently by their Arab neighbors. The only Arabs that are on their side appears to be, Hezbollah, Syria, and the Iraqis. But, in terms of the Gulf Arab states, the Palestinian cause has been betrayed from day one, and it continues to be betrayed today.
And how about the European Union? We know that the European Union trying to be silent, but at the end of the day, they're not happy with what's going on in Gaza. But what was the outcome of their policy so far, in your opinion?
I mean, they put indirect pressure on Israel, but not direct pressure. You see some political posturing by certain EU states by recognizing a Palestinian state. But other than the moment that it happens on TV and people cheering, it doesn't accomplish anything. The bombs are still dropping. People are still dying. You have the International Court of Justice making some very important decisions regarding Israel and genocide. And the European Union's not acting on those, as although they're empowered to do so, to hold Israel accountable. You have the International Criminal Court designating Netanyahu as a war criminal, arrest warrant out there, but no one seems to be pushing for the fulfillment of that arrest warrant. So there's a lot of political posturing by Europe that is designed to make them look good on paper, but the reality is they aren't supporting the Palestinian people, because every day Israeli bombs continue to fall and murder Palestinian children and Palestinian civilians, and Europe's not doing anything meaningfully to stop that.